Whitney.
I'm Danielle, and we are the founders of Saqqara Life, on a mission to nourish your body and transform your life.
Saqqara is a Sanskrit word that describes the action of turning your thoughts into things and manifesting your reality.
We believe that who we surround ourselves with, what we watch, what we listen to, what we eat, the information that we take in, impacts the way we think and therefore who we are.
The conversations that follow are with bold thinkers who have had an impact on how we view the world, ourselves, and what it means to live the Saqqara life. The intention of these conversations is to push each of us to greater heights so that we can turn our thoughts into things and all shine our light a little brighter.
We are so excited to be on this journey with you. Welcome to the Saqqara Life.
Here at Saqqara, we're forever exploring the connections between our brains, bodies, and rituals, and ultimately the role our minds and habits play in creating the lives we want to live. Today, we're joined by the renowned Dr. Daniel Z. Lieberman to discuss his books, The Molecule of More and Spellbound, Modern Science, Ancient Magic, and the Hidden Potential of the Unconscious Mind, and his work around dopamine's impact on our mental health. Dr. Lieberman is a professor and vice chair for clinical affairs at the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at George Washington University. He is also a distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association and has published over 50 scientific reports on behavioral science. I'm so excited to speak with Dr. Lieberman. I have so many questions for him. This might go in a few different directions today, but his work is just so fascinating, and I'm excited to dig into this more and how understanding ourselves more deeply, how our biology works, can support us in creating the life that we want to live. Please welcome Dr. Daniel Z. Lieberman. Dr. Lieberman, Dan, great to have you on the Saqqara Life podcast. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. Well, we like to start off every podcast with the same question, which is, what is your mission here on Earth?
Well, I am a psychiatrist, and that word has a wonderful root. It's from the Greek meaning doctor of the soul.
Wow.
So that's my calling. I help sick people heal, and I help healthy people understand their own minds better.
And doctor of the soul, that's incredible. I've never heard that before. And what was your calling to become a doctor of the soul?
You know, from a very early age, I knew that I was a science nerd and that I was going to be doing something in science. But when I went to college, I really wanted to get a really well-rounded education. And I went to sort of a strange college called St. John's College in Annapolis. There are no textbooks, there are no lectures, there are no exams. We read only original sources, the greatest works of Western civilization from the ancient Greeks to modern times. And it was absolutely fascinating. And it was all about productions of the human mind, philosophy, history, art, poetry, literature. And I realized that there was nothing more fascinating than the human mind. And that's what I wanted to spend my career doing, studying it and understanding it as best I could. And I spoke with one of my mentors, and I said, you know, I think I want to become a psychologist. And he said, I would like you to think about going to medical school because there are so many fascinating things happening on the biological front that future study of the mind is really going to involve the brain a great deal. And that's how I ended up a medical student.
Wow, incredible. You know, I've looked through your books and I've listened to some of your podcasts and the videos you do. And a question that came to mind was, where does our biology stop and the mind begin? Like, the mind is part of our biology, or is it something separate? How do you view that?
Well, you know, I think that we have to distinguish three domains: the physical, atoms and molecules, the metaphysical, spirits that have no physical existence, and the psychological, what it is that we experience. I write my books from a scientific standpoint. It's what I'm trained in. It's what I know best. And so I really focus on the physical and the psychological. It feels like our mind is separate from atoms and molecules. That's the psychological truth, what we experience from a subjective point of view. And so I would say that's the best way to treat it. Whether or not it's true, we have no way of saying, because science doesn't have tools to study the metaphysical, only the physical. So from a scientific point of view, nobody knows whether the mind is simply a product of the brain or whether it's something separate that doesn't have a physical existence. But from a psychological standpoint, we function best if we treat it as being separate.
That's so fascinating. And we know that our biology affects our mind. It affects our thoughts that we think. It affects our emotions that we have. So in your book, The Molecule of More, you speak a lot about dopamine and what a big role over our behavior and our thoughts and our desires that dopamine plays. Can you take us back a little bit and tell us about dopamine specifically, why it's so fascinating to you that you wrote a whole entire book about it?
When most people think about dopamine, they think about the pleasure molecule, the reward molecule. They think about how it feels when you eat delicious food or have sex or win a competition or get some wonderful news. And yes, that is a very important part of dopamine, but it turns out it's actually only a small part. What dopamine's real role is to orient us to the future, to making the future better. And so pursuing things that are evolutionarily beneficial, eating when you're hungry, reproducing, winning competitions, these are things that are going to make our future better. But dopamine does so much more than that. It not only gives us the drive, the motivation, and the energy to make a better future, it also helps us plot out that better future with the most sophisticated parts of the human brain, the prefrontal cortex, the part of our brain that uses logic and planning and abstractions. And so it really is dopamine that has made human beings dominant among all species on the planet, because we have the ability to plan, to use logic, and use abstractions like science, technology, things like that.
Okay, and so dopamine is driving us toward our future. And this can be a positive, like you said, driving us to take the actions that help put a roof over our heads, help put food on our plates, help us find a mate. But it can also lead us towards things that might not be the best for us. And I think it can also lead to some internal conflict, I would say. An example of that that you talk about is in relationships, right? Where we have this desire and like lust that is within us. It's part of our human nature. And when we're in a long-term relationship and we've already achieved that partner and we're in that long-term relationship, we don't feel that same kind of dopamine. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, dopamine can be enormously powerful. Not only does it give us tools to succeed and to dominate our environment, but it also just feels really, really good when you get a nice dopamine hit. So this combination of increased resources, increased sources of money, prestige, love, pleasure, all of those things, plus the pleasure of the dopamine itself, tends to make us really too one-sided in terms of our dedication to dopamine. And our society very much encourages this one-sided dopaminergic outlook, because with free markets, they're constantly trying to sell us things that they want to persuade us will make our life better. So your cell phone that is 1 year old is no good anymore. Get rid of it and buy a new one. The clothes you're wearing are out of fashion. Get rid of them and buy new ones. So we have this internal drive towards dopamine. We have an external drive towards dopamine. And when we become too one-sided, it's dangerous. So you mentioned love and relationships. There are few things more stimulating, more exciting than getting involved in a new love relationship. Falling in love is probably the peak experience of human existence.
I mean, I have friends who, you know, are in their 40s and they're not in a long-term serious relationship because that falling in love piece is such a rush that they'll find somebody, they'll have a ton of fun with that person. And then as soon as that initial stage is over, then it's kind of like on to the next one to get that dopamine hit again.
The problem with dopamine is that its rewards are short-lived. Dopamine can't allow us to be satisfied and happy for too long. Otherwise, we stop striving to make things better. So part of dopamine's job is to keep us dissatisfied. Now, dopamine is not the only neurochemical. There are other chemicals in the brain that will give us satisfaction because they're more focused on the present than the future. And in order to have a relationship last beyond the typical 12 months of the feverish excitement of falling in love, you need to be able to transition away from dopamine toward what I call the here and now chemicals, which will allow not the excitement and anticipation of dopamine, but rather the fulfillment and satisfaction that comes along with neurotransmitters like endorphin, oxytocin, and serotonin.
I'm still breastfeeding my son, and that rush of oxytocin, I mean, after giving birth, that is just, it's seriously like drugs. That rush of oxytocin is crazy and intense. And, you know, it is that bonding drug, and it really is satisfying. It pulls me into the here and now when I'm, you know, have that bond with my baby. And so how can people lean more into that here and now? If the dopamine makes us feel like we're never satisfied, we're always looking for that next thing, is that okay? The dopamine, it creates some level of happiness by striving for that next thing, right?
Yes.
But then it's short-lived, and so we need that second piece. Mm-hmm. So what have you learned? What are your recommendations in order for people to feel balanced?
As I was writing the book, I found myself falling into the habit of asking myself, am I in a dopamine situation or a here and now situation? So for example, when I'm at work, it's clearly a dopamine situation. I'm striving to make a better future. Many leisure activities are dopaminergic in nature. I like to write, I like to plan, I like to do tech stuff. And these are all about improving my life, improving the world. But when I'm interacting with my family, my friends, when I'm taking a walk in nature, I found myself realizing that I was still in dopamine mode. So I'd be taking a walk in the park and it's beautiful. And I'm thinking about, what do I have to do at work tomorrow? You know, when am I going to take my car in to get my battery replaced? These are future things. These are dopaminergic. And at the end of the walk that was supposed to be refreshing for me, relaxing and sort of reset, I'm not that way at all because I've been worrying the whole time about the future. So I started trying to recognize these here and nows and trying to pull myself into the moment. When I'm talking with a family member or a friend, I'm not thinking about what I'm going to say next. I'm not thinking about what I'm going to make for dinner. I'm trying to give my full attention to that person. And as a psychiatrist, I know just how powerful that can be. It's not common that somebody gives us their absolute full attention. And when they do, something kind of magic happens. And so it's a really good thing to try. Hard to do. Most people can't do it for 5 minutes straight. They find their mind wandering. But the more you do it, the stronger those circuits get and the better you get at it. And it's a very rewarding experience.
Yeah. A friend of mine the other day said to me, in a wealth of information, there's a poverty of attention.
That's so true.
That we're just flooded with, like you were saying, buy this, do that, change this. And I think in a way it trains our brain in that mode to be thinking, well, one, we're not good enough. What we have now is not good enough. And also even with our physical bodies, oh, I'm not thin enough. I'm not pretty enough. I'm not whatever enough. And puts us on this like ongoing, never-ending path. We see that with some of our Sakara-like clients that come to us, and we have to help them retrain their brain, retrain the way they think about food and about nourishment, that it's not about counting every calorie and fewer is better and these types of things, but really about nourishing the body and taking care of ourselves. Because if you're always on this path of trying to lose 5 pounds thinking that's what will make you happy, you could lose all the weight in the world and never find that happiness because it's really not about that.
Dopamine is always looking to the next rung, and it kind of lies to us. It tells us if we get there, if we lose that 5 pounds, if we get that promotion, we'll be happy and satisfied. And then we realize, no, it never happens. Dopamine as a molecule is just not capable of giving satisfaction. And we've got to realize about that deception that goes on in our mind and not fall for it.
And this makes me think about your next book, Spellbound, and where you talk about the conscious mind and the unconscious mind. How in order to start to get to know your unconscious mind, we have to start recognizing the thoughts we're thinking, right? And I mean, from my own personal experience in moving toward more self-confidence and self-acceptance and self-love, I've had to start to listen to what are those thoughts that I'm thinking? What is my self-talk saying? What am I saying to myself? And I didn't realize that maybe some of that self-talk is coming from that dopamine, right? That it's biology, that it's not just the mind chatter, but our animalistic nature driving us.
Yeah, you know, after I wrote Molecule of More, a lot of people came up to me and told me how useful it was to start seeing their brain in some ways as an independent machine. You know, we spoke about how the subjective experience of our minds is not always exactly lined up with the objective science of atoms and molecules. And from a psychological standpoint, it feels like we are in control of the things that go on inside our head. You know, sure, we can't always control our body. Sometimes we're tired, sometimes we're clumsy, etc. But surely we can control our thoughts. Molecule of More introduced people to the idea that, nope, there's stuff going on up there that's outside of your control. And I wrote Spellbound to really take that to the next level. And I love your example of self-talk. If you ask yourself, who's determining the content of that self-talk? Who's deciding what you're going to say? The obvious answer is, well, I am, of course. But in fact, that's not true. You actually have extremely little control over the self-talk. And wouldn't you like to know who's making those decisions?
Who is making those decisions? So take us back. Can you explain to us first, like, what is the unconscious mind versus the conscious mind?
The brain is composed of billions of cells that form very complicated circuits. The activity of some of those circuits are associated with our experience of consciousness, of being awake and aware. And that collection of circuits is sometimes referred to as the ego by psychiatrists. Ego can have a negative connotation, self-centered, arrogant, but here it's very, very neutral. Ego is the Latin word for I, and it just refers to what we mean by that person when we say I. Now, as it turns out, that ego represents only a very small percentage of the circuits in the brain. The vast majority of them are autonomous. They are outside of our control. And that autonomous part is 500,000 times more powerful in terms of its ability to process information. And we call that the unconscious mind. I think another good word for it might be the uncontrolled mind. This is the part of the brain that does its own thing. And it's more closely connected to the body than the conscious mind. And so the unconscious mind is responsible for things like regulating our blood pressure and our heart rate, secreting hormones, managing coordination of different muscles. But it has enormous processing power. It is responsible for most of the things that happen mentally in our lives, and we largely ignore it and don't realize just how profound its influence is.
We have our 9 pillars of nutrition at Sakara, and the 9th pillar, which some people are like, how is that a pillar of nutrition? It's body intelligence. Because ultimately, that's what we want to do, is to help your body function properly, you know, remove all of the endocrine disruptors and the other things that are disrupting your body's communication pathways and allow it to do what it needs to do so that it can send you the right information. And I've never thought about it before as this unconscious mind piece, but really that is a lot of what it is that our bodies have this intelligence to them. We don't have to tell it what to do. If you listen to it, then it will send you the signals, eat when you're hungry, stop when you're full, you know, and sometimes we don't listen to these signals. We can ignore them, but building that body in intelligence, building that body awareness, it allows us to take some of the brain work out of eating, where you don't have to count every calorie and carb and point and pound to feel good in your body.
If I want to raise my hand, I tell my body to do it and it does it. And that's great, but it can be deceiving. It can make us think that our relationship with our body is one of being a tyrant. We give orders and the body responds, but it doesn't work that way. The body has its own needs and it has its own goals. And if we get into this relationship of being a dictator to our bodies, it's going to do the same thing back. It's going to say, eat that junk food, don't exercise. And it's going to give us all kinds of bad directions. So that's not the kind of relationship we want to have with our body. We need to respect it and realize that it's in some ways its own personality. And what we need to do is we need to forge a working partnership with it in which there are compromises. I may want to do this thing, but my body's like, no, you need to chill. I need a rest. Or, you know, I want to go on a starvation diet and lose all this weight. That's going to piss the body off. And as soon as that starvation diet's over, you're going to put all the weight back on again. So you need to get to know your body like you would get to know a friend. Prepare to be surprised and try to forge that friendship type of working relationship.
Yeah, I love that. I think about the unconscious mind as it's faster, it's absorbing all of these different inputs that we're not consciously taking in. Like I would walk into a room, I might notice, hey, there's that person over there, but my unconscious mind might be taking in all these other people and what's going on that I'm not particularly aware of in that moment. And then it uses it when it needs to use it, right? And so is that what's happening through our childhood, taking in these inputs? How is it collecting its information and using it in the future?
The conscious mind has very narrow bandwidth, just really a very few bits per second. And so, for example, if you're reading something, if you're reading a sentence in a book, that's all you can do with your mind. You can't do that and plan what you're going to make for dinner or compose an email. But the unconscious mind, having 500,000 times more processing power, can take in so much more. And so it's processing all of this information, processing it in a different way than the conscious mind does. The conscious mind uses a linear, rational type of thinking. The unconscious mind uses a holistic, impressionistic kind of processing. So what is it doing with all this information? Is it feeding it back to us in any way, or is it just hoarding it? Well, it is feeding it back to us, and that comes in the form of gut feelings and inspirations. So you may be in this room, you may be focused on this one person. That one person may be wonderful and smiling, but you've got an uneasy feeling and you don't know why. Maybe there's something else going on in the room that you're not consciously picking up, but your unconscious is aware of, and it's sending out warning signals. Alternatively, you may be going through your day, bored, not thinking about much of anything, but your unconscious mind is just pulling in all kinds of incredibly valuable information, and then boom, out of the blue, you're hit with an inspiration. I once saw Cyndi Lauper being interviewed on David Letterman, and she said that she goes through months where she has nothing at all. Her brain is completely blank. She feels depressed. She feels down, sluggish, nothing. And then boom, she's hit with this flood of creativity. And so she learned that she doesn't need to panic during those periods of time. It doesn't mean that her creativity is over and she'll never think of anything again. She needs to trust. And that's a big part of Spellbound, is that we have to learn how to trust. We've got a co-pilot on board. That co-pilot doesn't take orders, but it can be an incredibly valuable friend if we learn how to work with it productively, as Cyndi Lauper did.
Well, Cindy's a Sakaralite, so we love her.
Oh, is that right?
Wow. Yeah, long time. But, you know, sometimes I do worry that for myself. Mm-hmm. It took so much inspiration, and it felt like literally a download from the universe flowing through us to create Sakara, that it was like this unconscious flow of information where sometimes we say that Sakara wasn't even created by me and Danielle. We were just the channels through which it came through. And so it has this feeling to it, but maybe this is a big piece of it, is that our unconscious minds was collecting all of this information around the world of people's needs and the needs of the world and the planet. And when it was the right time, it fed us that knowledge and information.
Yeah, there are few things more wonderful than when the conscious and the unconscious minds are cooperating together effectively. And it sounds like that's what's happening with Sakara. And we call it a passion. And when we're driven by passion, we're capable of enormous amounts of work without any willpower needed at all. And the quality of the work that we do, we look at afterwards like, oh my goodness, how did I ever pull that off? I'm not capable of doing that kind of work. And it's a wonderful feeling, but it's also a little bit scary, because once you start doing work of that quality, people start to expect it from you. And you say, well, where is this going to come from?
Yeah.
I can't control it. I can't whistle it up. I just have to, I don't know if be lucky is the right term. I think we have to be trusting. And that if we're trusting, if we do what we can to meet the needs of our unconscious, I think it will come.
I wanted to take a minute to tell you about a skincare brand we love, Fortuna Skin. You know, at Sakara, we care deeply about ingredients and only approve of the highest quality, and Fortuna Skin is the same. We know the founder and can tell you that she cares deeply about the products that she makes and the ingredients that go in them. Fortuna Skin is inspired by Italy's centuries-old secret to healthy skin and longevity, the olive. Their skincare line is centered around their estate-grown olive oil. Their patented sound bath extraction method transforms the fruits of their labor into the lineup of award-winning products. Packed with antioxidants, vitamin E, and omega-3 fatty acids, the nourishing olive oil and olive leaf water-based skincare line protects against free radical effects, rejuvenates mature and fatigued skin, and deeply moisturizes without clogging pores. No chemicals, no high heat, no solvents, just cutting-edge technology and pure potency. We love Fortuna skincare products because they start with the highest quality ingredients that are hand-harvested and sustainably farmed by generations of local Sicilians on their organic estate, and love it even more because of the immediate results that we see that only get better with time, which is another reason why they're our skincare partner for our Sakara Bridal Program. You can check them out at fortunaskin.com for more information, and be sure to use code SakaraPod at checkout for 20% off your purchase. That's SakaraPod at checkout for 20% off your purchase. That's an interesting way that you put it. If we can meet the needs of the unconscious, because I do think that that's what it is, that we're working so hard now. We have a huge team, a lot of Sakaralites who we're taking care of on a regular basis all across the country. And it's a lot of time, a lot of pressure, a lot of work. And I think that that puts me into my conscious brain very heavily. It's working my conscious brain. I'm thinking, I'm analyzing data, and I'm not doing the things that I was doing in those moments that the download for Sakara came through. I was a lot younger. I had more time. I didn't have kids and a husband and all these responsibilities. I was doing a lot more yoga and connecting that mind and body together, which I think yoga does, and getting some of those downloads while lying in Shavasana. I think about the things that for me were the things that my unconscious mind needed to be taken care of. What are some of the things that you have found in your work to take care of the unconscious mind?
So those are great examples. For me, the main thing is meditation. I started doing that while I was writing Molecule of More in order to give me a little bit more discipline within my mind, not to always be mind wandering off in the future, to be able to stay in the present moment, which, as you know, is difficult. But yoga is wonderful, and taking care of the body is a form of taking care of the unconscious mind, getting exercise, getting good sleep, getting good nutrition. But there's another one as well that I think is a little bit trickier, and that is that we have to recognize that our unconscious mind is full of treasure. It's full of inspiration and passion and energy. It is also full of darkness. The unconscious mind is amoral. And as amazing as its gifts are, its darkness is just as powerful. And I think that part of taking care of the unconscious mind is accepting that darkness, not acting on it. You know, paradoxically, the more we accept the darkness of our unconscious, the less we have to act on it. It's when we reject it and we pretend, oh no, that's not part of me. I'm not that kind of a person. It's when we reject it that it takes over and makes us act in spite of our best intentions. And we see that all the time. We see powerful, brilliant, successful people destroying their lives and their careers because of an unimaginably bad episode of poor judgment. And we say, oh my God, where did that come from? We say, what possessed that person to do such a thing? And that's exactly the right question. If we reject the dark parts of ourselves, they will possess us at times and make us act in what feels like very uncharacteristic ways.
What a lesson in this. I mean, coming out of this cancel culture time that we've been in, where we haven't allowed anybody to make any kind of mistake. And look, there was definitely some value in it. Some people needed to be canceled. Some people are dangerous, you know, et cetera. But I think that we've taken it a bit far as a society where we're looking for people to make a mistake. Yeah. And sometimes I think about, you know, if I were to ever want to become president, I'm not saying that I ever would or that that's a path for me, but it just runs through my mind that I don't think I could be because maybe I subscribe to a newsletter that the public wouldn't approve of because I'm open to different viewpoints and I want to hear different sides and different thoughts out there. Or, you know, I've smoked pot and have taken hallucinogenic drugs, the world would look down upon that and say, you're not perfect. You can't be this leader. And so how is anybody going to be the leader that we're all looking to have if we want them to be flawless when it's within our nature to have equally as much goodness and passion and strength as it is to have that darkness?
Yeah, that's right. It has such negative effects. You know, I often read an article and I have thoughts about that article that I want to share with people, but I don't comment on it because I'm afraid. I'm afraid that maybe I need to spend more time thinking this through. Maybe there's something important that I'm missing and I'm not going to get a break. No one's going to say, oh, he didn't think it through. He'll do better next time. They're going to pull that out of context, say he's a horrible person. The funny thing is that if we were to talk to the people, the most judgmental people there are, they would say, I'm in favor of peace and love. And I think pretty much 90% of people would say, I'm in favor of peace and love. And yet, as a country, we are at each other's throats. And I think that what's happening is that we are not dealing with our own demons. And so these neglected demons are being projected on the other. And we are attacking our demons externally because we refuse to accept the fact that they're internal.
Wow. Yeah. Having so many different thoughts coming up right now and needing to do this self-work. I think for me, some of this self-talk comes up when I'm going to post something to Instagram. I think, you know, I don't post as much in my stories or share about my personal life, maybe as much as Danielle does, because I don't know, it is one of those things where maybe I'll doubt myself or think about, well, how will this person feel if they see this post or that type of thing? Is that a good thing? Or how do we work through those thoughts and fears of what other people will be thinking?
It's a very difficult question because this experience of everybody living their life in public is new. It used to be that we were careful with who our confidants were, that we would carefully choose friends who were trustworthy and supportive, and it was to them that we would open ourselves up to. Now we're opening up ourselves to the world, and we are sharing very personal things with everybody. There are probably some benefits associated with that, though they're not coming to my head right away, but there certainly are a lot of risks. And so I wonder if maybe we're going to see the pendulum swing. And people might say, you know, sharing myself with the world, becoming kind of a little bit of a mini celebrity among my group is really exciting. I sure got some dopamine out of it. But ultimately, that's probably not the most effective way to carry on social relationships. I don't know. Maybe we will find lots of great things in it.
I mean, you just have to look at a lot of the celebrities, especially ones who were child celebrities from a young age and grew up in the public eye. It didn't work out for a lot of them. They ended up in rehab or whatever else. So I think there is something to that. And perhaps maybe my hesitance around certain posts or whatever is my unconscious mind helping to protect me.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's a really good thought.
And listening to that, you know, as an entrepreneur in our early days with me and Danielle, we would talk to certain investors and they would ask us about how we make decisions and how much data we have and analysis goes into things versus making decisions off of a gut instinct. And I almost would feel bad, like, you know, having imposter syndrome or something, like I'm not good enough or don't have the right tools or something to be able to make these decisions, but they were the right decisions. And now listening to you and what you put into your book, I realized that, you know, my unconscious brain was collecting a lot of that data and making the right analysis in those moments.
Yeah. And I think that in some ways that question contained a false distinction. In some ways it says, do you use your conscious or your unconscious mind? You use data or gut feelings. And the best thing is to use both.
Mm-hmm.
I find myself very much dependent upon inspiration. I work by having good ideas pop into my mind. And although I cannot control those directly, I can make them more likely to happen by doing the relevant digging. And so when I'm faced with something new, when I've got to make an important decision, I will read as much as I can, not with the expectation that I'm going to rationally figure it out, but I'm feeding my unconscious mind by reading. And eventually that inspiration is going to pop into my head. So I think the best is when the two can cooperate.
Yeah. You talk about this concept of transcendence. Can you explain what that is?
All right. So we made just a huge, big jump.
Well, I see it kind of as a connection from what you just talked about of
combining the two.
Yeah, bridging these two together.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. One of the most important parts of life is learning how to forge that good working relationship with the unconscious mind and to merge the two of them into a complete whole self. And when that happens, we experience transcendence. Now, that's a big word. It's a fancy word. And usually we associate it with like sages or monks and stuff. But it's actually an area of active scientific research. And there have been questionnaires developed where you can measure how much transcendence people have. And not everybody goes down that path of increasing transcendence. But a large number of people do. As we age, it naturally occurs and wonderful things come along with it.
What does it look like? Like, how do we know if we're in transcendence?
One big thing, there are a few different domains. One important domain is that we become less dependent on external things for our own satisfaction and happiness. So we become more satisfied with our physical appearance. We don't have to appear to be like a Hollywood movie star and impress people. We don't need to buy a $1,000 outfit because we're comfortable with who we are. We don't need to impress other people. We need to love them. And if they love us back, wonderful. And if they don't, that's okay because we don't need to be loved by everybody. It's really about focusing more on who we are rather than what other people expect us to be.
And how do we, what are the practices to get us there?
It's not easy.
No, it's not easy. I talk about this with actually a girl that works on our team about building self-confidence. Like, how do you build self-confidence? What are the actions, the practices that we can do to build self-confidence for ourselves and then also for our Sakara lights? Because ultimately, I think taking care of yourself and your body and your health and your nutrition is really important, you know, no matter what your desired goal or outcome is. But some people come in with that desire to change their physical body, to lose those 10 pounds, whatever it is. And sometimes I think about that. We don't need to give them the weight loss. We need to give them the confidence and that self-love. And so I think about this a lot of like, how do we do that?
Yeah. Being a human being is a very dangerous thing to be. It's rough. So if we ask ourselves, well, what increases transcendence? Transcendence increases naturally in many people, not everyone, as we age, very slowly. But there are some things that lead to big jumps in transcendence, and that is adversity. You look at people who had a battle with cancer or who had some other great tragedy. Maybe they lost their spouse at a young age, and maybe that spouse was the breadwinner, and now they're destitute, and they've never had a job in their life, or they've never had a good job in their life. These terrible episodes of tragedy are what lead to transcendence for people who navigate them successfully. It is dangerous to be a human being because not everybody navigates these successfully and they get crushed. And that's just part of life. Life is dangerous and it is full of risks. And the people who achieve the highest levels of transcendence are often the people who walked the hardest road to get there. And so we've got to prepare ourselves to face adversity. We have to learn how to be disciplined. We have to learn how to make sacrifices. We have to learn how to love. We have to learn how to accept love. We have to learn how to be vulnerable. We have to meditate, exercise, and do yoga. It takes everything we've got. If we hold back anything, we're not going to reach our full potential.
Yeah, so almost like leaning into those risks. I wrote down in my notes here as we were talking that you can create change by going against the ego. That our ego, I feel like, wants to keep us doing the same things because that's safer.
That is so right. Yes. The ego wants to hang on even when it's time to let go.
Yeah. And so if we want to create change, I mean, creating change is really hard. It's a bumpy road. But the way that we do it is, I always say this, if you want things to change, then things can't continue to stay the same. So you have to go against your natural instincts. I mean, talk about this even in relationships. If you're fighting with your spouse or whatever, and you're thinking to yourself, well, I'm just not going to talk to him for the next day. How could you go against your natural instinct and instead say, well, I'm going to do the opposite. I'm going to lean in. I'm going to show even more love. I'm going to go talk to them right now. And I find that that's really where the most change comes from. But that's taking a huge risk, right? And it's scary.
Yeah, it's taking a huge risk, and it's doing exactly the opposite of what we feel inclined to do. And you're right, that is the pathway to growth.
Okay, I have a question for you. I mentioned hallucinogenics before, specifically talking about psilocybin. I talked to this psychiatrist who uses psilocybin in her practice, and she explained that we reduce our neural pathways as we age, and around the age of 25 or so, our brain has kind of chosen the most efficient pathways for us, and that psilocybin opens up new pathways so that we can have new ways of thinking. What do you think about that? Have you studied that at all?
I think that's a great description. I'm fascinated by the biology of the brain. And if we think about it in terms of brain chemicals and receptors, there's a serotonin receptor that the brain activates when we are in novel changing situations. And it's a signal that says it's time to let go of the old ways of adapting and try something new. In psychiatry, we have a lot of drugs that block this receptor. And it can be very helpful for people with illnesses like schizophrenia, anxiety, and depression. It makes them feel very safe and comfortable, like they're in their favorite comfortable chair, wearing their old favorite sweatshirt, and everything is the same, and nothing is a challenge. Mm. And then psilocybin does the opposite. And when people take psilocybin, one of the first things they say is, all of a sudden, everything that's familiar appears to be unfamiliar, because we're artificially stimulating this receptor that says, new situation, time for new adaptations. And the results can be so dramatic. People struggling to give up addictions suddenly say, that part of my life seemed irrelevant. Why would I smoke cigarettes? That's ridiculous. And then they stop. People with depression for years overcome their depression, and all kinds of wonderful changes are possible. Now, I
was going to say, but it doesn't sound like it's for everybody.
Thank you. I'm so excited about psilocybin. So many mental health professionals are, but it's not for everybody. I made a YouTube video about how psilocybin works. And one of the comments I got from somebody was, I was involved in one of these studies. I took psilocybin, and it actually had a very negative effect on me that lasted for months.
Wow.
I'm not using it in my practice, and I'm not going to until it's FDA approved, because we're really getting a sense of what it can do, but we don't yet know who should not be taking it.
Right.
And that's a crucial step.
No, absolutely. Just like I would say, being a big risk taker isn't for everybody. I think you said before that, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs and people, they have to be a bit crazy, you know, to do this, because there is a lot of risk involved. And I feel that. I know that we're running close to the end of time. I've just found this conversation to be so fascinating. And there is a question that I would like to ask you. Well, really, I'd like to ask you your thoughts on God, if that's okay. It feels like through history, some of what our unconscious mind has been doing has been labeled as God. When things just happen, or we get these downloads, and wondering your thoughts on what is unconscious mind, or do you feel like it's all unconscious mind and just science, or is there something that is more to that is God?
Yeah, sure. So I can speak as a person, and I can speak as an expert. So as an expert, as a scientist, we cannot prove the existence of God. We cannot disprove the existence of God. In fact, and I wish we had more time to go into this, but let me just make the statement. In fact, there is zero evidence that science is capable of giving on both sides of those questions. It's as if science and faith are on completely different planes that do not intersect in any way. But there's some interesting things science can say about God nonetheless. Let's start with just making our assumption that God exists, okay? And we can say God exists, God created us, and he communicates with us. How does he communicate with us? Well, one way he communicates with us is through his creation. We see the beauty of his creation. We see the beauty of the sunset, the beauty of flowers and trees. We experience the love of other people, and that's also God communicating to us. And these are all examples of God creating to us through our conscious mind. Now, God has another doorway he can come in, and that's through the unconscious mind. And what does that feel like? Well, that feels more like a direct presence of the supernatural, when we feel as if we are in the presence of something holy and divine. The technical term for that is the numinous experience, and that has been studied, the phenomenology. We know a lot about that, and that's the unconscious being activated in a way that makes us feel the presence of divinity. All right. So I would say that is the relationship between the unconscious and God, that it's another way he has of coming into our life. I think that most people who've experienced this would say it's their favorite way of having God come into their life because it's so moving and it's so pleasurable. And you just feel like, okay, everything is right with the world. And even though I see all these terrible things happening, at the base of everything is love and fairness. And in the end, everything is going to work out. Now, I do want to say that science could also assume the non-existence of God and say, yeah, all of these psychological experiences happen, but it's just neurochemical interactions taking on in the brain. And yeah, both explanations are equally valid from a scientific perspective, and each individual has to choose which one has the ring of truth to them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, who knows, maybe we'll never know, right? Maybe we'll only know after we're not here. So
I think that's true. I think that's part of the plan. Because if science could prove the existence of God, there would be no more faith. Because you need faith because it's not proven. And once it's proven, we have no choice.
Is faith related to dopamine?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Just tying it back to the beginning.
That's right. That's right. Faith involves believing in something we cannot see. And dopamine is the neurotransmitter of the possible, of the imaginary and the abstract.
In a way, that's part of what makes it so powerful, right? It is that we will never be able to finally achieve and just have what we believe in. You have to have that faith, and it's kind of ongoing and it's always out there until we reach our final destination, so to speak.
And there is no faith without doubt, and it's uncomfortable. And we try and make our lives happy and satisfying and easy. And yes, we should do that, but we should never lose sight of the fact that fundamentally life is hard. And there's nothing we can do to change that.
Yeah. Except maybe living in the moment as best that we can.
Yeah, right? I think that's right.
Well, I mean, I could just continue to talk to you for hours. I know that you're very busy and we need to let you go. But before I let you go, I would love for you to give a light work exercise to our Sakara Light listeners, something that you want to give them as kind of their homework to start putting into action what we've talked about today.
Psychology, particularly psychology of the unconscious mind, deals with paradoxes. In the unconscious, the opposites are united. And so my recommendation with regard to light work is really going to focus on darkness. The human mind has the divine ability to transform darkness into light. But in order to do that, we've got to accept the darkness. And in fact, that is the mechanism by which it's transformed, via acceptance. So my challenge to your listeners would be, pay attention to what's going on inside your mind and see if you can identify something very dark. Maybe it's envy, hatred, anger, rage. And don't push it away. Don't act on it. Don't act on it. You don't have to act on it to accept it, but allow it to occupy your mind. Almost savor it the way a wine connoisseur would save a fine old vintage. Get the subtleties of that negative emotion. Find out as much as you can about it, and you will transform it into a form of strength.
Wow. I have like full body chills. It just feels really powerful. And sometimes when we pull out those pieces of ourselves that we wanted to hide and we feel ashamed of and whatever it is, and we bring them out into the light and air them out, they're not so bad anymore.
That's right. That's right. It turns out to be the seeds of something good.
Mm, beautiful. Well, thank you so much, Dan. It has been such a pleasure speaking to you. Everybody should go out and read your books, Molecule of More and Spellbound. And I hope to have you back on the Sakara Life podcast in the future so that we can continue this conversation. It was really incredible.
Thanks, Whitney. I enjoyed it so much.
Today, we're getting back to the basics of Sakara. And so we wanted to share a bit about our Sakara Signature Nutrition Program for all of those listeners that are new to us. We created this program after healing ourselves to help others feel the same transformation that we experienced through the power of food as medicine. This program is based on the science behind a whole food, plant-rich diet and has been crafted around our proprietary 9 pillars of nutrition, which focuses on things like nutrient diversity and eating the rainbow, eating your water and getting enough sulfur-rich veggies into your diet, as well as cultivating body intelligence in order to have true mind, body, and soul transformation. The Sakara Signature Nutrition Program makes clean eating easy. It's entirely free from meat, gluten, dairy, refined sugar, pesticides, harmful chemicals, and GMOs. The menu is chef-crafted and changes weekly to highlight seasonal ingredients and recipes, so you never have to sacrifice taste for eating healthy. If you're interested in learning more about our Sakara Signature Nutrition Program, head to sakara.com to see how you can customize the program to fit your needs and lifestyle. That's sakara.com. And for a limited time, we wanted to give you all a gift of transformation. So use the code PODCAST20 at checkout for 20% off your first order of Sakara Life. I think so many of us are so busy these days trying to take care of the entire world around us, whether you're a busy professional or a mom. I encourage you to give this gift of nutrition to yourself. You deserve to feel amazing in your body. And when you nourish yourself, then you're able to better take care of the world around you and share your special gifts with the world.